punk fans, welcome to this week's Punk News Podcast. It's the one for the week of August 6th, 2013. I'm Brian Yancey, and I am here with John Gentile, a special two-person podcast. Chris Moran might be joining us later. He might not be. Got some technical difficulties we're dealing with, but the show must go on, as they say. John, how are you tonight?
I'm doing pretty good, pretty good. I'm excited to see if Chris Moran jumps on or not. And I have to say, you know, the past 2 weeks, I was like, not a whole lot of news this week, not a whole lot of news this week. But we got a lot of news this week, and it just goes to show, be careful what you wish for, because I got to say, some of this news is definitely bumming me out. That's what I got to say.
Yeah, and we'll get into that news in just a couple of minutes. First, I want to read you a couple of emails. As always, you can send us emails. podcast@punknews.org is our email address. If it's good, we'll read it on the show. And we got a couple good ones. First of all, Natalia writes, "Hi, I was listening to one of your podcasts a while ago. Sorry, can't remember which episode. And John Gentile was talking about how he wanted to get into jazz music. I'm afraid I didn't come with any recommendations for you, John. Instead, I was wondering if you could offer me some punk recommendations. I started listening to this podcast mainly because I wanted to discover some punk music I could listen to. Honestly, I have no idea where to start. I am as uneducated in the world of punk as they get, and I need help. I was wondering if maybe someone over at Punk News could offer me some advice on which artists, albums, or songs I should start off with. I'd really appreciate the help."
Well, Natalia, what's nice about punk rock is there's almost a definite start point, so punk 101 is relatively easy to figure out. Here's my recommendations. Yance, you can disagree or counterattack if you want, but my advice, Natalia, is start with the classics, then check out the newest of the new, and then find what you like from there. So here's what I'm going to say, Natalia. Go to the record store. You can get most of these used on CD for $5. Ramones, first album. It's just called Ramones. Clash, first and third album. Clash, first album is just called Clash. Third is called London Calling. You want to get the Dead Kennedys first and second album, Fresh Fruit for Rotting Vegetables and Plastic Surgery Disasters. You want to get the Germs discography, which is called MIA, Missing in Action. It's about 22 tracks. You want to get the Misfits, I guess their collection one. Check that out. And you want to get Black Flag's first 4 years. I think if you start there, Natalia, all those bands are pretty different than each other. And then, oh, and also you might want to check out the Minor Threat discography and also the Bad Brains. It's called the ROIR cassette, but it's actually just like a self-titled CD as well. I think you check those out, and then from there, you can pick what you like and check that out. You know, spread out once you get a taste for the fundamentals, the founding fathers of punk rock. I would also suggest that if you want to check out new stuff, there's a lot of really, really good bands out there right now, brand new bands and sort of new bands. You should check out brand new bands. There's a band called The Garden, which is just two guys. They're minimalistic. They're twins. I think it's phenomenal. You want to check out Nobunny, which is great modern garage rock. You want to check out World Inferno Friendship Society, which is one of my all-time favorite bands. They're not super new, but they're super unique. That's World Inferno Friendship Society. And other new bands you might want to check out would be Crazy and the Brains, which is like just a straight-up classic rock and roll punk rock band. What do you think, Yance? Do you disagree or agree with my selections?
That's a pretty comprehensive list. And I would mostly agree. I think that's all of that is a great place to start. It's a pretty good cross section of kind of where punk started and kind of where it is now, more or less. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff in between, obviously, that's also good, but if you're getting started out with punk, I mean, you got to check out the classics first. You can't have some newish, not really punk band. I can't think of one right now. You can't have that be your first punk band necessarily if you're looking for recommendations. You know, I would also say that, I was going to say maybe like, Natalia, you could just walk into a record store and maybe ask for a recommendation from an employee, but record store employees can be kind of surly. So
yeah, I'd advise
maybe don't do that, but
yeah.
Maybe check out, just keep reading the site and, you can always check out, Wikipedia is a good source for punk history and great punk bands. Obviously not as good as punknews.org. We are kind of the Wikipedia of punk rock, I feel like, in our own way, but All of John's suggestions are sound ones, I feel. So anyway, second email, and this is also directed at John, in regards to the Black Flag versus Flag debacle. Johnny writes, "I just have one question I had heard long ago in regards to logos and likenesses. If there were enough of a difference in appearance, I thought something like two differences, but I'm sure I'm wrong on this. One could really prove this was a different logo altogether. I guess my point is, if you look at Flag social media sites, the four black bars are all straight across and in line, while the Black Flag logo has always had the bars offset to be more of a wave rather than a rectangle. So is this enough of a difference to at least dispute this part of the claim? Not to mention Flag always capitalizes their logo while Black Flag does not. I mean, if this was true and he could sue a band named Flag, could he then go after Anti-Flag for that matter? I know Guinness covered his basis with more than just this as his claim, and the injunction, which we're going to talk about in a second, will more than likely put a monkey wrench in some remaining dates Flag has scheduled, but I was curious nonetheless. I mean, why isn't Black Flag Pest Control getting in on this?" So, Johnny, we're going to answer that. I guess we can do it right now. Let's jump right into the Greg Ginn lawsuit. So, in case you haven't heard, on August 2nd, Greg Ginn, who of course is a founding member of Black Flag and SST Records, filed a lawsuit in federal district court against members of Flag, as well as, and this is interesting, former Black Flag vocalist Henry Rollins. So the crux of the suit alleges that the Flag name and related imagery, infringe upon the Black Flag trademark, of which Ginn claims ownership. The case becomes more complicated, however, as Ginn did not actually file for trademark registration for Black Flag-related marks until June of this year. Further complicating matters, Keith Morris and Rollins have both claimed ownership of the Black Flag marks by registering their marks with the United States Patent and Trademark Office last year in 2012. So, in addition, the suit alleges that when Chuck Dukowski sued Ginn in 2007, the parties settled, and as part of the settlement, Dukowski disclaimed any ownership of Black Flag-related marks. So Ginn has asked for money damages as well as an injunction preventing Flag's current touring activities, which include a bunch of dates they have lined up in September and beyond, I believe. So you can read the entire lawsuit. We've got it embedded right there on Punk News for you. It's a nice 20-page document. And John, I know you have a lot of insight on this, and this is what Johnny was asking in that email, and I assume everybody else who does not email us is wondering as well. So what do you think, if you can predict it, will be the outcome of this, and how do you see this whole thing playing out?
Well, here's my prediction. It's going to be very, very messy. Very, very, very messy. And honestly, we could talk about this for hours. We literally could. And I think it'd be a pretty exciting conversation. We're not going to talk about it for hours. But as proof as to how exciting this is, Adam White is making a surprise phone call because he wants to get in on this. So we're going to call Adam White real quick, and then we're going to continue this conversation. So here comes Adam White. We're ringing right now, folks, to get Adam White's. Adam White, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Adam, yeah. we heard you were so excited to talk about Black Flag that you had to call into this episode. Is that correct?
Yeah. All right. Well, incredibly. Yeah.
So anyways, Adam, I was about to lead the kids on a thrilling discussion of trademarks and Black Flag. So first, to answer Johnny's question, Johnny brings up a good issue. Johnny asks, when is a trademark no longer infringing on another trademark? Here's the answer. When the judge says it's not. So the kids know is there's three main types of federal intellectual property: trademarks, copyrights, and patents. A patent is an invention. We're not going to talk about that at all. A copyright is a work of authorship. What that means is a copyright is the bundle of rights you have when you write a book, when you make a movie, when you make a statue, when you record a song, when you write a song down. Your bundle of rights associated with that is a copyright, okay? However, we're focused here on trademarks. Roughly speaking, what a trademark is a trademark is a logo or a mark or a word or something else used to identify the source of a product or service. So the Coca-Cola name is a trademark because when you see the word Coca-Cola, you know, oh, that comes from the Coca-Cola company. Likewise, the Nike swoosh, when you see that symbol, you say, oh, that's from Nike. That's a trademark. Does everybody understand what I'm getting at?
Yes.
Okay. So Johnny asks, when is the Black Flag trademark no longer infringing? And the answer is when the judge says so. And here's how the judge decides. When you file a trademark lawsuit, basically the court goes through an 8-factor test to determine if something is confusingly similar or not. A trademark is infringing when it's confusingly similar. What confusingly similar means is that means when someone buying that product is not sure the source of that product. So, for example, if you made a company called Loca-Cola, you know, people might say, well, is that from Coke or not? That would probably be confusingly similar. The court determines whether something's confusingly similar by going through an 8-factor test. Depending on which federal circuit you're in, the test is slightly different, but the main parts of the test that are in all the circuits are how similar do the logos look, are they in similar fields of service, and how similar is the product. So Johnny's question is could anti-flag be confused with black flag? Could that be a trademark infringement? Well, the answer is maybe, but doubtful. However, good question is, could the word flag in all caps be confused with black flag? And the answer is, well, I don't know, and I'm not going to make a guess. I hope not, but I mean, the names are similar. And unfortunately, a lot of publications have been referring to black flag and flag as two versions of black flag, when really flag is presenting itself as not a version of black flag, but as flag. So what that means is, here's what's going to happen, is black flag has filed a lawsuit, and it basically has two prongs of attack in it. The first is that the name flag and all the associated activities are confusingly similar to black flag. That is, black flag is saying when people go see a flag show, they don't know if they're getting something from Greg Ginn or somebody else, okay? Pardon me. And Greg Ginn is also saying flag is doing that intentionally. The problem is I think flag would probably be able to get out of that, but the problem is a lot of publications are calling them a version of black flag, which they're really not, and they're not even calling themselves that. Also, Greg Ginn has said that they've been making, quote, bootleg black flag t-shirts. If they've been making their own black flag t-shirts, that may or may not be a problem. But if they're just buying black flag t-shirts from somebody else, probably not a problem. Here's the other issue where it gets a lot stickier, way stickier. Black flag never filed for the black flag trademark until 2013. You don't have to file for a trademark in order to protect it. You can actually protect a trademark as soon as you put your item into commerce and people associate that trademark with a source. What registering a trademark does, it gives you some extra punch or some extra benefits. Namely, you can get punitive damages in certain situations. It also gives you prima facie argument that your trademark is legitimate. However, Black Flag didn't file for the trademark till 2013. Where this gets mysterious is in 2012, Keith Morse and Henry Rollins filed for the trademark, saying they had been using it and they claimed ownership, which is kind of a weird thing to do, don't you think so? Are you guys there?
A little bit, but yeah, we're here.
Yeah. And so Greg Ginn is arguing that they did that to steal the Black Flag trademark from him and that they have no rights to the Black Flag trademark, and that he has the rights to the Black Flag trademark. Now, really, he should have tried to cancel that trademark when it was filed, but I guess he was unaware it was filed. I don't know why Henry Rollins and Keith Morse would file that. To me, that seems to invite a lawsuit. So I would have to think that Keith Morse and Henry Rollins expected a lawsuit by filing for that trademark. Obviously, we don't know all the facts, and we probably know like 1/100th of the facts. So maybe Keith Morse and Henry Rollins have been using the Black Flag trademark for the past 35 years or whatever, and maybe they do have a legitimate claim for it. A big part of this case is going to hinge on who has the rights to the Black Flag trademark. Obviously, if Henry Rollins and Keith Morse own the Black Flag trademark, Greg Ginn loses everything. But right. If Greg Ginn gets the Black Flag trademark, is flag confusingly similar to Black Flag? Very tough call, and I'm not going to make a judgment. I'm going to say I hope not because I love flag, but I got to say, if I was Black Flag, I would probably file a similar lawsuit, to tell you the truth.
Really?
So can you clarify something for me here?
Sure.
Does it matter at all does it come into consideration when someone's trying to rule on this, the fact that flag is clearly named flag to imply or to bring to mind Black Flag? I mean, given that they play Black Flag songs, given that it's ex-members of Black Flag, everyone looks at Flag and I guess is going to look at it and go, yeah, we get it. It's not Black Flag, but it's guys from Black Flag or something like that. Like, does, you know, if the band's name was Banana, would this not be a problem?
Excellent question. And here's the answer. And it goes back to Johnny's original letter. Johnny said, well, if there's two differences in a logo, does that make a difference? And the answer is, the court doesn't count differences in a logo. What the court does is they look at one logo and they look at the other. And in the eight-factor test that I discussed, how similar the trademarks are is something in the court factors. And it's usually the biggest factor. There's a lot of scholarship on this. And most people that have written papers on this say it's the most important factor. So what the court does is they'll look at the Black Flag name and logo and look at the Flag name and logo and say, well, is that likely to confuse consumers? Obviously, Black Flag's going to say, of course it's going to confuse people, Your Honor. It's just half the name, and it's the same font. Flag will counter and say, of course it's not confusing, Your Honor. We specifically made it Flag instead of Black Flag. Our consumers are what they call sophisticated consumers, and that they know a lot about the products they're reading, so nobody would get confused about this product. And honestly, I think that's probably true. I think less than 1% of people are confused about the difference between Black Flag 2013 and Flag.
I mean, I would have to argue that sophisticated consumer thing sounds like it would probably factor in here, because, you know, these aren't bands that are, you know, out playing to, you know,
fairgrounds,
tens of thousands of people in a right. Yeah. What was that?
Oh, that's me blowing my nose.
I thought it was a dragon. Okay, no, but the you know, these aren't people that are, these aren't bands that are playing to anyone that isn't, you know, that isn't in on the joke, for lack of a better word. You know, people are going to these shows because they have some sort of nostalgic connection to Black Flag, because they're aware of Black Flag, and that, you know, this is a way in which they can see the, these guys that were in that band back in the day play. So, you know, it's not. There's not like, you know, 50,000 people that are in an arena, and half of them are going to be like, what? Where's Greg halfway through it?
True, true. And yeah. A lot of articles, particularly Punk News articles, have specifically pointed out the differences here. Oh, the other main factor I forgot is actual confusion. Actual confusion is a big thing in the eight-factor test. Very big element. And what Flag has against it is, you know, Rolling Stone magazine has called this two versions of Black Flag. But, I mean, you could counter and say, yes, Your Honor, that proves that people aren't confused, because everyone's saying it's two versions of a band, you know? So, like I said, it's going to be messy. It's going to be messy.
So who do you think has the upper hand based on, I mean,
honestly,
which side? Because, like, it's interesting, like, it's really odd that Morris and Rollins filed this trademark a year ago, and that Greg Ginn only did it, you know, 2 months ago. So, like, is that going to factor in to this lawsuit, like, when it's heard, and how much will it factor in, if at all?
Well, I mean, who files the trademark first has no bearing on legitimacy of trademarks. However, what Rollins and Morris could say is, like, look, court, we filed first. It means we really want it, and we've been using it. They didn't do it, and they had 35 years to do it. By contrast, right. Greg Ginn can say, look how they're trying to be devious and fool the consumer by saying they own it, when I've clearly put out Black Flag records for the past 35 years. Here's a real problem for Flag, though, is the jury is usually defense wants a jury trial. Here, I would not want a jury trial. In America, defense gets to pick if you get a jury trial or not. Oh, no, I'm sorry, not always. In federal court, if either party wants a jury, you get a jury. I would not want a jury, because chances are your jury is not going to know who Black Flag – I mean, we talk about Black Flag like they're the Rolling Stones or Bruce Springsteen or the Beatles, you know, but most people do not know who Black Flag is. So when the jury sees, like these guys that haven't been in Black Flag filing for the trademark after, like, 30 years or 25 years, they're going to think they're going to try to be sneaky, when they don't understand the whole mythos and conflict and interactions these guys have had for the past 35 years. You see what I'm saying? See – Greg Ginsler is going to be like, look at this hardworking guy who's been putting out records for 35 years, and this guy who they kicked out of the band in 1980 is now trying to file, no, 1979, he's trying to claim the trademark. He hasn't been a Black Flag since 1979, while Greg Ginsler's been putting out Black Flag records for the past 35 years. Isn't that devious, jury? And the jury will say, wow, what a scoundrel, when they won't realize that you know, there's been a lot of interaction between these guys, and both sides have used the Black Flag mark. However, and I find this the most interesting. Actually, I find two things the most interesting. The second most interesting thing, I think, is I wonder if Greg Ginn shot himself in the foot. I mean, really. Federal court has what's called compulsory counterclaim. In federal court, if somebody sues you, if you have a cause of action against them for the same cause of action, then you have to sue. If you don't sue back, you lose your ability to sue. For example, Brian, let's say you and I get in a fist fight and you sue me for punching you. I have to sue you for punching me. You and I get in a fist fight and you sue me for punching you. If I want to sue you for punching me, I have to file a lawsuit right then or I lose my ability to sue for that. So what this means is that basically the people named in the suit are Henry Rollins, Keith Morris, Chuck Dukowski, Bill Stevenson, Dez Cadena, and Henry Rollins. They basically have to sue for back paid royalties, or else Greg Ginn would try to argue later on, this is part of that whole thing, and they should have sued for it then. So, I mean, if I were their attorney, I would definitely say, you got to sue for that right now. And also gives you, you know, a lot of leverage in negotiations, you know. But continuing, so, I mean, really, Greg Ginn, like, he could lose a lot of money on this. Because, you know, Henry Rollins and Keith Morris are always saying that they never received one penny from Black Flag, you know. So,
right.
And they've sold a lot of records. Another thing is Henry Rollins, he's got a lot of money by now, right?
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah, I mean, he's making more than $40,000 a year, right?
Okay. Most likely.
So, and Henry Rollins has put out a lot of books and CDs. So he's got to have a lawyer, or like, not a full-time lawyer, but he has a lawyer that he regularly deals with, right?
Yeah, he's probably got somebody on retainer, I would think.
Now, I could see Keith Morris, like, because, I mean, honestly, Keith Morris never got any money from Greg Ginn, and Greg Ginn did snub Keith Morris for years and years for his contributions to the band. So I could see Keith Morris just saying, I'm going to file for this trademark because I hate Greg Ginn. But Henry Rollins has got an attorney. Don't you think Henry Rollins' attorney is going to say, Henry, if you file this, it's definitely going to be a lawsuit. So I got to think they either definitely wanted a lawsuit or, and I have no evidence whatsoever, this is a pure guess. Did somebody else file for the trademark under Keith Morris and Henry Rollins' name?
Oh, I don't know.
I mean, because, I mean, like, if Henry Rollins was my client, I'm like, Henry, this is a lawsuit. It's going to result in a lawsuit, I can guarantee you, you know?
Right. Yeah, that would be, I don't know why that would happen, but, I guess stranger things have happened, right?
I'm not going to make any guesses, but, I mean, it's not too hard to think of a fanciful scenario where this could happen to people's benefits, you know? I don't know. I mean, this is purely a guess. And I probably sound like Alex Jones over here, but I find it so difficult to believe that Henry Rollins would do this without knowing it's going to result in a lawsuit. So my only assumption is he either won in a lawsuit, and maybe he did, so he can, I don't know, countersue for royalties, even though he could just sue to begin with, or somebody's acting sneaky. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess we'll have to see what happens. It's like you said. I feel like it's already getting messy. It's only going to get messier as time goes on.
It's going to be messy. Yeah.
Yeah. So
here's the one thing that I would really got to wonder about this though is that what's and maybe this is an unfair comment because, you know, clearly I don't have a stake in this suit, but. When they get into something like this, is there no thought to, especially because this has to do with art and it has to do with you know, with a band. Is there no thought to legacy here? Like, let's say Greg wins and Flag is crushed under the boot heel of the official Black Flag or whatever. I don't think that, like, the public opinion is necessarily going to be on his side. So what...
What did he do?
Just start playing Black Flag shows and just, you know, telling everyone to suck it up and this is what they get? Or what? Or Flag just changes their name and keeps doing what they're doing and maybe doesn't sell Black Flag-ish t-shirts and everyone, because we're talking about a savvy consumer base, everyone would fucking figure it out immediately what the band's new name is and things would continue on as they were before all this mess. Like, I don't see what the outcome of this is.
Well, I feel like for the most part that... in the court of public opinion, quote unquote, that Greg Ginn is already on the wrong side. And whether or not he knows that or even cares about it to begin with, I'm not sure. I would guess that he either doesn't know that or is delusional in some way, or he just doesn't give a shit. And, you know, he's going to do this anyway, and whatever happens, happens. And, like, I don't think he's worried about his quote-unquote legacy. I don't think he's worried about any of that stuff, to be honest with you. John?
Well, you guys are both thinking like attorneys, but the problem is clients don't think like attorneys. Clients think like clients.
Right.
There's a lot of bad blood between these guys, a lot of bad blood, you know? So they're not necessarily thinking financially or legacy. They're thinking is, this guy's doing something that's hurting me. I want to damage him. However, that being said, is if I was Gregan, I absolutely would definitely move to cancel the Henry Rollins, Keith Morris trademark. Not that I think they're wrong. I'm actually on Keith Morris and Henry Rollins' side. I hope they win. But if I was Greg Ginn's attorney and I would say, Greg Ginn, the Black Flag trademark is your company. I mean, that. What else is there? You know, nobody's buying Tom Tricali's dog CDs. Nobody's buying October Faction CDs. You know, the Black Flag. So if Henry Rollins and Keith Morris got the Black Flag trademark, it would basically prevent Greg Ginn from operating SST Records. So you have to, you know, snatch that up and protect that and not let Henry Rollins and Keith Morris get that trademark.
Right.
So I mean, like, honestly, like if I was Greg Ginn's attorney, I would say even if it hurts your legacy, you have nothing without that Black Flag trademark. That's where your money comes from. We have to move for that. As for blocking Flag, I guess they just want to do damage, you know? I mean, honestly, because nobody thinks Flag is Black Flag. Everyone understands that Greg Ginn is in one band and everybody else is in the other band, you know? And I'm really bummed out about this whole thing. A, because I hope Keith Morris and Henry Rollins don't get hurt, because I hope they win. But I'm also bummed out because this whole time I didn't want to take a side. I wanted to say they're both cool, because they were both cool. But now I got to take a side, you know?
Right. Well, I guess we'll see what happens. This could draw itself out into quite a long ordeal.
Yeah.
But anyway, moving on. Jesse Michaels is going to release a book on September 10th. It's called Whispering Bodies. It's a novel, not some sort of biography or punk history. It is a fictionalized novel. And the book serves a character named Roy Belkin, who suffers from neurosis and is suspected of murdering his building's maintenance man. A version of this book was previously self-released in very limited quantities last year. So Jesse Michaels writing a book. I actually got my copy in the mail today. Pretty excited to dive into it. What do you guys think about punk rockers writing novels? Is there like some punk personality that you would want to see write a novel necessarily?
Well, who's done stuff like this? I guess Dr. Frank from the Mr. T Experience.
Dr. Frank, yeah, that's the most obvious one.
Henry Rollins wrote. Was it the Sophilist Man or whatever it's called?
I'm not familiar with that one.
Yeah,
but I believe you.
And then Nick Blinko wrote the Primal Screamer.
Right, I've heard of that one.
I don't know if I don't know if there's like a huge precedent of other guys doing this sort of thing, or if they do, they may not. You know, they may not. You know, they may keep it, I guess, you know, far enough away from their music career that we don't necessarily talk about it too much. I feel like there's like a really obvious one that we're not talking about, but I'm not sure. So what does this book look like? Like how big is this sucker? Is it like a novella? Is it a full?
It's a novel. It's not like a Game of Thrones or a Lord of the Rings type length, but you know, it's a few hundred pages. It's in the other room, so I don't have it in front of me right now, unfortunately. I'm super prepared for this show. I got the copy of the book today. I knew we'd be talking about it tonight, and I did not bring it to the table with me. So, yeah.
Are there any maps of strange and mysterious lands in it?
You know what? I'm just going to go grab it really quick. You guys talk amongst yourselves. I'll be back in 10 seconds.
God, I hope there's maps in this.
I just finished reading not too long ago. Oh, I'll tell you who else has written a couple of books is Jack Terrycloth. He's written like some noir books, and they're okay. They're pretty good. Nick Blanco's book was pretty good too, but it's really weird. Nick Blanco, Rudimentary Penile. It's actually like semi-autobiographical, but he lies. But the weird thing is the other main guy in Rudimentary. Well, there's like
all right, guys, I got the book.
Yeah, one of the main guys in Rudimentary Penile is Nick Grant. I mean, Grant Matthews, and he almost died of cancer but lived. But in the book, Nick Blanco has him dying. So like, what if like your friend that you've known for a while wrote a book where you die a horrible death in the book?
Hmm. Granted, we've discussed before that Rudimentary Penile is not necessarily the most balanced.
No, he's insane.
Yeah. Okay. I was trying to be nice.
No, he's insane. But I'll tell you who's only slightly unbalanced though is Jesse Michaels.
That's right.
So how's that? Okay. So you got the product in front of you. What can you tell us about this sucker?
Well, it is.
It is a book.
It's a book. It's a paperback. No hardcover. There are no maps or illustrations of any kind. There's no section of photos in the middle of the book, which frankly is a little disappointing. The book is actually relatively short. It's 218 pages, or no, 219, excuse me. So seems like a pretty light read, something you could read in a few days and a few afternoons. And
how's the font maybe, look?
the font is fine. It looks like a regular, I don't know, 10 or 12 point font. It's not a large print book. And yeah, it's a book.
How's it smell?
It smells like a brand new book, which is exactly what it is. So, I will read it, and maybe in a couple of weeks we can have a Punk News book club, and I will talk about the book.
I think we should do that, but Brian, I think you should randomly read three sentences from it right now.
I will. All right, I'm flipping open the book. I don't know if my mic will pick this up. This is the sound of the book flipping.
What if he like hits like the one big spoiler? It's like, and Steve murdered the guy.
All right, let me find a good one here. Well, let me try to find something good.
Adam, I think Jesse Michaels would be a pretty good book writer, novelist.
You know what? I would. He's led, I think, an interesting enough life outside of what we know, you know, about him from a musical standpoint that I just have to imagine that just from a life experience standpoint, he may have, you know, been able to concoct something a little bit different than what you would expect from someone who's, say, been touring for the past 30 years.
Yeah,
so.
Well, not only that is he's got a significant life away from music. Like, you know, Tim Armstrong's always been in music, basically. Glenn
yeah,
Danzig.
So that's what I mean. What
yeah,
I mean.
Yeah. So.
All right, guys. I've got a passage from Jesse Michaels' new book, Whispering Bodies. This is, as far as I know, a worldwide exclusive. Here we go. Bud Morpello was behind his desk with his mouth open and eyes half closed. Once again, the room was very dark, but Belkin could make out that there were two men seated near Morpello. One of the men looked like another detective or something. The other one was an arrestee in handcuffs. He looked familiar to Belkin. He had dark curly hair, unruly eyebrows, and angry moles on his face, and the style of a 1970s New York Greek shithead. There you go.
I'm digging it.
That's a world exclusive right there. A very brief
angry moles.
Excerpt.
Wow. All right.
From Whispering Bodies, a new book by Jesse Michaels. There you go. All right. I think we should break for a song now. John, do you want to do yours or should I do mine?
I've got something angry because we're talking about angry molds. Tank Crimes Records is a record label up in Oakland. They put out mostly punk rock, heavy metal, thrash metal, and crust punk, so pretty wild stuff. They put out a record by a band called Vitamin X, who's from Europe. I think they're from Sweden, maybe? Vitamin X has been around for about 25 years, and they were one of the first bands to really do crossover, like early DRA, DRI, that is thrash metal and punk rock put together. They Tank Crime just put out a brand new record by Vitamin X, and it's pretty fierce. I wouldn't say it's retro because this band has always been doing this kind of music. So if a band has been doing a kind of music since it was brand new and still does it, is that retro or true to the old school? I don't know. But this is a cool song off Vitamin X record, and it's called Crank It Up.
That a fierce song Vitamin X.
Woo!
Wow. That really blew my hair back. So anyway, back on the Punk News Podcast. Once again, I'm Brian. I'm here with John Gentile and Adam White. Adam White, who valiantly stepped in and called into the show at the last minute, subbing for Chris Moran, who I believe is still working out his headphone problems or something. I'm not sure. Anyway,
they don't have
we're going to talk about... Yeah, there's no internet in Richmond. It's a very old city. It's been around since, the 1600s, so they haven't quite figured it out yet, but there's hoping they get there soon.
Plenty of tobacco, though. Tobacco, all you want.
Yes, absolutely. And that begins and ends.
And racism.
That begins and ends the things. That begins and ends the facts we know about Richmond. Okay. So Ian MacKay has confirmed that a Minor Threat t-shirt on sale at Urban Outfitters is in fact legitimate and licensed. The chain, who are famous for decorating their retail sites like the secret lairs of Tumblr-themed Batman villains, which Andrew Waterfield wrote and is really funny, has the garment on sale for $28, which is more than double the price Discord charges for Minor Threat's complete discography. MacKay was asked about the t-shirt, and he said, quote, "It's not a political thing for me. I just don't give a fuck about t-shirts. I spent so much of my time chasing down bootleggers, and it's a complete waste of time. Do I think it's absurd? Yes, I certainly do. Motherfuckers pay $28. That's what they want to pay for their shirts." So MacKay told the Washington City paper that the band licensed their shirts through California-based T-Cert Clothing, who authorized Urban Outfitters to sell the shirts. This is a pretty weird story, mostly because I love MacKay's whole cavalier attitude toward it, just that it's not even something that really concerns him, despite the fact that people have been and still are associating, you know, this sort of thing with him, you know, not necessarily in the wrong by doing so, but at the same time, you know, it seems like every time something that has to do with Minor Threat or Fugazi appears in some sort of media or is on a shirt, somebody has to email Ian MacKay and get a quote from him about it or call him or whatever. And I can't think of anybody else in punk or any genre of music really where that's the case, where it's like, yeah, that's the most interesting part about this story to me. But I'm really curious to see what you guys think about the whole licensing thing and MacKay's attitude toward it and everything else surrounding this story. Would you pay $28 for a Minor Threat shirt from Urban Outfitters?
Yes, well, I would.
I think
go ahead, Adam.
All right. Well, sorry to interrupt you there. I think the big distinction here is that, and this doesn't necessarily justify anything, but I think it's like the point of clarification that we need to make, is that it's not so much a shirt from Urban Outfitters, it's a shirt from this T-Surfed company. And right. if you go and you look up this company, you know, this company, you know, and I'm just looking at their Facebook page right now. So it's exclusively music related stuff. Looks like they put out products for, as of May of this year, they welcomed NoFX to the T-Surfed family. Looks like they put out stuff for, Bad Religion and Blink 182 and, you know, a bunch of other bands and stuff like that. So, correct me if I'm wrong, maybe it's like an exclusive thing in Urban Outfitters. I don't know, but it seems like this is a company that sells shirts that have been licensed from bands. And Urban Outfitters happens to be, you know, the retailer that is carrying these ones in particular. But I'm trying to look at this from Minor Threat's perspective here. And if Ian's looking and going, all right, fine, we need to have someone sell our fucking shirts. Here's this music company that a bunch of other punk bands and a bunch of other musicians use to sell their shirts. I'm going to license it to them, and they're going to sell the shirts, and then fuck off. Then all of a sudden it pops up in the news. We're like, Urban Outfitters is Minor Threat's official T-shirt provider to rich people. Then all of a sudden it, you know, there is absolutely still the debate about, you know, whether Minor Threat, you know, should be selling official shirts or licensing official shirts at all. But I don't know. I feel that framing it as an Urban Outfitters issue and attaching that brand and whatever that brand means to people to this story is not the full truth.
What I'll say is,
yeah, that's fair. I mean,
that's what I'm going with.
I don't think Minor Threat was ever an anti-capitalism or anti-money band. I think Minor Threat, and more so for Fugazi, the main point was treating people fair. I even think there's an interview where Ian MacKay says, "I never said I was against money. You know, I just want to make, you know, do it fairly." And I think Minor Threat should make T-shirts. I mean, the fact of the matter is, if the market has such a demand for something that there's bootlegs, I think it's the ethical thing to make an official one. Because why should some thief or some guy that wants to make an easy buck, why is he more entitled to the money than the people that actually made the thing? If anything, if those people were really against it, I mean, they could donate that money. So anything to stamp out bootleggers, I'm all for. Not to get too off topic, but when I interviewed Penny Rimbaud of Crass, he basically said, "I don't have anything against money itself. It's the common currency. It depends how it's used. If I got $60,000 and used it to open a women's homeless shelter, well, that's a good use. If I bought weapons for some more, that's a bad use." So I don't think a band selling T-shirts and making money is inherently bad. I don't think it hurts Minor Threat's heritage or legacy at all. And I think the only people that think it does have no idea what they're talking about and haven't really listened to what Ian MacKay or the band was saying to begin with. However, that being said, as I checked out this T-shirt company, well, and also, you know, the Urban Outfitter brand, one is $28. You can get the same shirt on Interpunk for like $12. So that's Urban Outfitter having a big markup, you know. It also means getting the T-shirt company, kids. However, what I will say, Ian MacKay's big thing is always be fair, you know. $10, $5 for show, which I think is too cheap. You know, $12 for CDs. That's fair, right? But I looked up this T-shirt company, and I gotta say, I could not find anything where they said that they were made in America or even anti-sweatshop, which means these shirts probably are sweatshop, you know, shirts, or, you know, made in Pakistan or Belize, places where they have pretty bad factory conditions. And I gotta say, that is something I cannot front. You can't say you want to treat people fairly and then have 7-year-old kids making your clothes. Brian, you asked, would I pay $28 for a Minor Threat T-shirt? My answer is, if it was made in America, or at the very least, if it was made by a non-sweatshop company, I absolutely would. This, I think, is made in sweatshop conditions, at least the T-shirt itself is, and so I wouldn't buy it for a dollar, you know?
Sure, that's fair. I actually wonder if that's the case now. Unfortunately, that's not something that had crossed my mind, and now I kind of want to walk into an Urban Outfitters and like look at the tags on these shirts and see what they say.
Well, let's put a call out to the kids. Kids, if you see in these official Minor Threat T-shirts under the T-Surt brand, that's T-S-U-R-T, look at the label and see what company it is and see if it says where it's made, and then let us know at podcast@punknews.org. I'd be very interested to find
out. Absolutely.
Yeah.
as would I. Okay, so the Descendants are very, very slowly recording a new album. I feel like we've talked about this before, but this is the first. This is kind of the first like actual update that has like some meat to it. Under the Gun talked to Bill Stevenson, and he mentioned that, quote, the record is in the embryonic stages. I have my studio, the blasting room. Stephen Egerton lives in Tulsa. He has a studio too. Milo even has a real small recording apparatus in his basement. Carl still lives by me. So I went in a couple of weeks ago and recorded. So we got 11 songs done, but just the drums. We'll be passing those around. Stephen will be putting guitars on them. Carl will be putting bass on them. Milo will be singing on them. We'll get rolling, but it's not going to be like, oh, it'll be done in a month. It's going to take us several months. So the band's last full length, What's Cool to Be You, which was released in 2004. And this is exciting, but hang on, because the way Bill answered this question makes it sound like the new Descendants record, when it comes out, will be recorded in separate studios, four separate studios, maybe three if Carl records the blasting room with Bill. Three separate studios, let's say. That doesn't sound very good to me. I think when bands record songs separate from each other, there's a certain something that's kind of intangible, but there's a certain something there that gets lost when you're recording in that fashion. So I really hope that this is just like the demo stage, and that when they have these songs hammered out, they're going to all go to the blasting room or some other studio wherever together as a four piece and record these songs. But I'm curious what you guys think about this, as well as bands recording apart from each other. You know, is there an example of when it turned out okay? Because I can't think of one. Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
I'm sure that if you actually broke it down, there's a lot of examples where renowned recordings have ended up, you know, been produced that way. And I mean, like, I'm sure like a lot of like the latter day Beatles stuff, when they all hated each other, was recorded and assembled in that way. But I might be wrong there.
Yeah, actually,
but,
I gotta pause you right there. The White Album, all four Beatles were only in the same room all at once on 4 days total while the recording of the White Album.
There you go.
Right. So, I mean, yeah, so that definitely happened. So it doesn't, I mean, it might give me pause, because I think from that, you know, I want to say that I really like the sound of things that are recorded kind of live from the floor more than things that have been overproduced or, and, you know, overassembled or overthought in that way. So, you know, I want to say that, that's, you know, maybe that's not so good, but on the other hand, hey, new Descendants record. So, I'm gonna wait and hear the thing. I need new Descendants stuff, so I'll just live with that.
Right.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Is I think especially in hip hop, but I don't really know any stuff in punk rock, but you can just tell when they didn't record it in the same room, like with some hip hop. And I'm a pretty big Wu-Tang fan. I'm not a maniac, but I'm a pretty big fan. But you can totally tell on so many of those recordings where they just had one MC like do a couple of verses and another did a couple of verses, and they just like synced them together, and they have nothing to do with that with each other. On some Wu-Tang ones, they even cut the guy off halfway through the verse, and it's like ridiculous, but nobody seems to care. I do think music is not as good as when they're, you know, there together, bouncing ideas off each other, seeing what works. And I think it's the collaboration that makes so many of these bands so magical. That being said,
especially a band like the Descendants, who have such like a unique sound and such like a dynamic about them. Like the fact that those four guys would, you know, who are like extremely talented musicians, would, you know, do that. And I don't know, it kind of rubs me the wrong way. I don't want to get too bummed on something without even being recorded yet, without me hearing it. But I mean, the most obvious example that's fairly recent that I think a lot of our readers/listeners will think of is the Hot Water Music 7-inch, their comeback 7-inch, which was two new songs that they recorded separately. And as such, the songs came out a little limp. I mean, they didn't have a lot of personality, like they were fine, but, you know, not even close to the band's finest moments. And then they all got together to record their last full length at the Blasting Room with Bill Stevenson, oddly enough. And, you know, that turned out pretty great, and most everybody really liked that record. But they were all there, you know, together with each other, collaborating, you know, bouncing off ideas, that sort of thing. You know, what bands are supposed to do when they record albums together. So, yeah, you know, Adam's right. I agree with him. It gives me pause as well, but I don't want to outright dismiss the thing without having heard it first. But I sincerely hope that, you know, they end up together recording this thing.
The counter argument, though, is what if they say, well, it's either that or you don't get a Descendants album at all?
You know? Well, I mean, again, that's a good argument, and it's really hard to say without having heard it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
If it's terrible, we could just say we don't want one at all. But if it's good, we say, oh, yeah, you guys made the right decision. You
know? Yeah, exactly. It's impossible to say. I mean, without having heard it, I would almost say that I would rather just not have them record another record if that's how they're going to record it. But, you know, obviously they're not going to fucking listen to me. Like, I'm pretty sure none of those dudes even know who I am. So, you know, they're going to do what they want to do, and that's fine. You know, it's not going to make them any less cool. It's not going to tarnish their reputation or legacy in my eyes. You know, I'm always going to love them, and I'm always going to love their music, but, you know, yeah. So, final story. Let's do it. Who's excited for Cassette Store Day?
I am.
The trick question, it's weird because there are no cassette stores. There are record stores. There are CD shops. There are Best Buys, but there are no cassette stores. But anyway, so Cassette Store Day is going to happen on September 7th. And it's exactly what it sounds like. A bunch of bands are going to release limited edition cassettes. As far as the details we have, it's just going to be cassette versions of albums that already exist. It's not going to be new material or demos or previously unreleased stuff of any kind. But there's some fairly heavy hitters involved in this. At the Drive-In, Guided by Voices, Fucked Up, Suicidal Tendencies, The Flaming Lips, a few others are going to be releasing cassettes of stuff that they've done on September 7th. So you can check out the details of Punk News. John, you said you were excited for Cassette Store Day.
I am, but more so...
Elaborate.
I'm more interested in defending the cassette as a whole. Here's what I'm going to say. First of all, the cassette is the second worst format of music there is. Well, actually, I would say third worst. It's way worse than CDs, way worse than records. It's better than 8-tracks, and I say it's better than MP3s just because it's physical, and I always prefer the physical over MP3s. However, it sounds terrible. They break all the time, so the cassette is not a great format. However, for some reason, the cassette is cheaper to produce than a CD, which blows my mind because a CD is just a piece of plastic, like a solid, unmoving piece of plastic, where a cassette has, like, what, 1, 2, 4 moving parts and screws and a whole bunch of other things. But a cassette is cheaper to make than a CD's, and the pressing plants require a smaller run. That means labels like Burger Records, Baldy Long Hair Records, and some other labels don't take as much of a risk when putting out physical music. At both Baldy Long Hair and Burger, I think it's twice a year they have a sale. Their cassettes are usually $5, but twice a year they have a sale where the cassettes are $3.33 each. And what that means is I'm way more likely to just check out a band if I hear, like, a sound that I like or just a song that I like. And I'll be like, screw it, $3.33, send it on over. You know, limited edition, there's only 150, 300 of them. It's a fun little collectible to have. And maybe I'll really like the band. And the fact of the matter is, and it's going to sound like I'm getting payola from Burger Records, but I've gotten, like, 7 cassettes from Burger Records that I really, really, really liked. I've gotten a couple of stinkers, but basically is because Burger Records doesn't have to have a whole lot of overhead when putting out these cassettes, they can put out something that they're not sure about if it'll turn a profit or not. They can just put it out and see what happens. Because at most, they're risking, you know what, $500, $800. I've gotten into this band, The Garden, which I'm a huge fan from just because I bought their cassette because it was $3.33. I got Personal and the Pizzas, fantastic band. I got The Hound of Love, who was one of the guys from Mean Jeans, fantastic album. And, you know, for $3.33, I love it. It's even better when it comes to the digital download. So you get the physical and the digital download. Baldy Longhair put out Crazy in the Brains, The Disconnect. All these phenomenal bands that I can check out for 3,033 cents and have a physical product. And sometimes, because the cassettes have such a long running time, they put on extra tracks. Like, well, Effed Up has all those mixtapes, which are really cool. But, like, the Dwarves cassette has extra tracks. And I love rare music. So I love them. I love cassettes. I'm all for them.
You're the only person I know with a cassette player.
I actually bought a cassette player specifically for, like, for Burger Records, for Baldy Longhair Records.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I really did.
Huh. Interesting.
I've been really, I think, consistently anti-cassettes on this show for, God, probably for as long as we've been talking about them on this show. So, while I find John's enthusiasm totally understandable and you know, I admire it, I'm not going to, I don't think I'm going to change my opinion that this is, you know, one of the shittiest formats for music ever that really deserves to have been, you know, long, long, long ago brought out back behind the barn and shot and just thrown into the creek to rot and have animals tear away at its carcass. Only because I don't feel that, I mean, while I totally get what John's saying where, you know, it is cool to have like a nice little physical trinket sometimes. There's a lot more interesting physical trinkets, I think, that I would rather personally have from a band than a cassette. And in terms of needing, you know, listening to music or rare songs or anything like that, well, we have the internet. There's, you know, I can fit lots and lots and lots of things on the internet. It's just, there's tons of space here. We can put all sorts of rare stuff on there for people to listen to. So, and again, I get the emotional satisfaction that you may get from plopping in this cassette and, you know, sitting through it to the point where all of a sudden this rare thing pops up and part of the experience is that you've heard it in this format on this piece of plastic that you went and got that is a physical thing and is a token, blah, blah, I get all that, but I'm pretty sure that I can replace all those experiences with things that are not cassettes and be very happy. So, I don't know. I mean, the cassette thing to me has always seemed a little bit too
cute,
a little bit too cheeky, a little bit too like, ha, ah, we're all going to wink and oh, you know what fuck I'm going to say. It's a little bit too fucking hipster for me. Which is a term I never use, but it is totally hipster. Where, and, you know, the fact that this event even exists, you know, and the event itself is a little in-joke because there are no cassette stores, so we're going to make cassette store day. Just, there is no way these things can exist without, like, some sort of half-serious, ironic wink involved. And I'm too much of a joyless bastard to buy into that.
You know what I'm excited for is a mom jeans day and unkempt beard day. I'm going to both of those. I got my new mom jeans, you know.
Is there some sort of catalog of where all these days are so we can know which one to keep up on? Because I never know what day it is.
Well, the mom jeans and unkempt beard day, I don't know if they're actually officially sanctioned, but go to any House of Vans show in Brooklyn this summer, and that's when you will find the mom jeans day and the unkempt beard day.
Yeah, every day is mom jeans day. I got to say, honestly, like most fashion is stupid. Mom jeans aren't like the best fashion, but they don't look terrible, you know?
Yeah, sure. Whatever people want to wear. I got no qualms with that.
I mean, I think some girls are kind of cute in them, to tell you the truth. I mean, I wouldn't say like that, like the best. Like if you really want to be as good looking as you can, I wouldn't say wear mom jeans. But I mean, you know, I'm not gonna not go out with a girl because she's wearing mom jeans. That's for sure. You know.
You hear that? I'm too far removed from, I don't know what cities, I guess, to have any idea what you guys are talking about.
You don't know what mom jeans are?
Well, no, I do. I didn't know it was a thing.
Yeah, it's like a huge thing. Like, all the hipster, well, girls mostly, are wearing mom jeans or mom jean shorts. So the kids know, like, mom jeans are jeans that are, like, really high-waisted. Like, literally, like, 2 inches, 3 inches above your belly button. So it's almost like a Victorian-era, like, trussle.
Oh, my God, I saw that today.
Yeah, it's just, like, a thing. And, like...
Yeah, they were like, cut-off shorts. And I was like, what? Okay. Sure.
That's
it's a thing. Oh, I didn't know it was a thing.
It's totally a thing.
I need to creepily hang around more high schools so I know what things are things.
Hey, girls, what are you wearing? I'm just trying to keep up with the times.
Yeah.
All views and opinions of the Punk News podcast panelists are the opinions of those expressing them. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, cassettes are a day. I don't own a cassette player. I guess if I could find one, like in a thrift store for a few bucks, I might think about picking one up.
Be careful.
But even then,
be sure to test it because most of my cassettes are rare cassettes. Because I mean, like, I'm not gonna buy a cassette if I can get a CD or a record, you know. If you and the listeners out there, if you get a used cassette player, test it with like some shitty old, like, you know, like, I don't know, Bruce Springsteen or Billy Joel cassettes first that you can replace, because some of them will just destroy them. I lost a Yellow Man for 19 cents. I got Yellow Man Sings Christmas Hits, and I was so excited to get it. I ordered it. I spent $3 in shipping on it. So I literally spent 15 times in shipping what the thing cost, and I get it, and I'm like, this is going to be awesome, Yellow Man Sings Christmas. I put it in, and within 3 seconds, it gets snapped by my cassette player. But the point is, I want to add this on. The whole point of what makes cassettes cool, in my opinion, is that they're cheap to produce and quick. So, you know, on record store day, sometimes records are like $35, which is ridiculous. So as long as these cassettes on cassette door day are like $5, $6, $8, I'm cool. But if they make these like 12, 15, 20 bucks, well, then I will be anti-cassette store day.
See, I have a feeling that's what's going to happen. Like, yeah. You know that plenty of cassette's going to be at least 10 bucks, maybe 12 or 15.
To just make it a CD record, you know?
Yeah, those guys will take a buck anywhere they can get it. Yeah. Not saying that in a bad way. That's just how they are.
Have you seen the mom jean market? Mom jeans are really expensive these days, too.
I can't say I've paid very close attention to the mom jean market.
I invested, so I've got a horse in this race, you know?
Okay, yeah, that's fair. All right. I guess it's all the stories we have for this week. I have a song, however, that I'm pretty excited about that I want to share with you right now. It's from a band called Psychic Teens. They're from right here in Philadelphia. And their second full length, which is called Come, is coming out next Tuesday on SRA Records. And it's really, really great. If you're not familiar with the band, and I'm going to guess most of you aren't, they kind of play an interesting brand of like super dark, super heavy, like 80s influenced goth slash post-punk. It's really cool. And their first record was was good, but this new one, which I've had for a couple of weeks now, is like way darker, way heavier, way more goth, and it's way more awesome. And it's honestly one of the best records I've heard this year. And I'm not just saying that because they're from the city where I live. I believe Spin is streaming the entire record right now. If you want to go check that out, highly recommend you do so. And if you're local to Philadelphia, they're playing a release show this week on Friday night at Long and the Tooth Records, which is in the Rittenhouse Square-ish area in Center City, Philadelphia. So you should check that out. It's a free show. I will probably be there, probably. But anyway, their new record, like I said, it's called Come. It's coming out next week on SRA Records. This is actually the title track from it. And again, the name of the band is Psychic Teens. that's it for this week's Punk News podcast. Thanks to Adam for filling in last minute. Thanks to John for being here always.
Woo!
Yeah. Thanks to Psychic Teens and Vitamin X for the tunes. Thanks to Nightbirds and Fat Records for the theme music. Thanks to Nariman, our ever-present but always silent sound person, for producing a show.
He's silent but deadly.
Yes, for making us sound way better than we ever deserved to sound. Thanks to everybody who listened. Thanks to everybody who emailed. And again, you can email us at podcast@punknews.org to get involved in the show. We highly encourage that. We will be back next week. And yeah, we hope you'll tune in. So until then, this has been the Punk News Podcast for the week of August 6th, 2013.